Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and this is the Capital Connection. Joining us today is one of our best participants in the show, Ken Lovett, Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Daily News and author of the must-read Albany Insider column, which appears in the news every Monday. Ken Lovett, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be back.
So I want to ask you, let's start out, corruption. I personally, who am scared of my own shadow, can never understand why these people continually get themselves into trouble by stealing. What is it that makes them think they can get away with it?
Well, a lot of them think they're smarter. A lot of them think, I won't get caught. You know, why do you climb a mountain? Because it's there. They've got all this stuff around them, and it's just thrown, and they see other people doing it, and they can't help themselves, I guess. But it is amazing that, you know, even after all we've seen in the last few years, people are still getting pinched.
So in New York City, you've got a story in the paper now about a New York City councilman. What's the deal there?
His name is Reuben Wills, and he used to be the chief of staff for Shirley Huntley, who right now is behind bars for a year and a day for stealing member item money. While he was her staffer, the state directed, I think it was $33,000 to a nonprofit that he was tied to, Reuben Wills. He became a city councilman, and Eric Schneiderman, the attorney general who brought down Shirley Huntley, then went after, was looking into this because they found that the $33,000 grant that went to Reuben Wills' nonprofit, they couldn't account for the money. The nonprofit, there was no records of it being spent. Nobody knew where it went. Wednesday morning, he got arrested. He and a relative who worked for him got arrested by the AG's office and is being charged with grand larceny.
You know, the worst news here, Ken Lovett, is for all the not-for-profits who do good work and who will now have to hire two more people to fill out 16 more reams of paper because what one or two crooks do.
Well, and it's been a bad couple of months because not only did you have Shirley Huntley last year and now Reuben Wills, but don't forget you had William Rapfogel, who is headed for 20 years a prominent Jewish poverty charity down in the city, the Metropolitan Council on Jewish Poverty. He's very close to Sheldon Silver. His wife is Sheldon Silver, the Assembly Speaker's chief of staff.
And has been forever.
And it turned out he was in a 20-year kickback scheme that stole from the charity $7 to $9 million and netted him a cool million.
Now, remember, this is a guy whose wife, Shelley's most, I don't mean this in any nefarious way, but intimate staff member who knows everything that goes on. And she was not in any way implicated in this, nor was Shelley. He said, I don't even know this guy, but their kids, they ate dinner together, their kids went to summer camp together, whatever. This is extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, look, she says she was unaware, you know, whether people believe her or not, there's no evidence to the contrary. Sheldon Silver says he was unaware, and again, no evidence to the contrary, and there's been no charges or even, as far as we can tell, an investigation into the two. Whether or not the Attorney General's office looked into them hard, we don't know, but certainly we're told that there was no connection.
Well, you know, when the feds do something, it's always done differently than if the state authorities do something, because let's face it, if you're a state person, you have to deal with Shelley Silver sooner or later, or maybe your allocation for staff disappears or whatever, the potential for that happening. So here's Preet Bharara up there. Do we think that the FBI has any interest in this story?
Again, there's no evidence to say that they're looking into it. I have not heard a single thing about that.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's got his hands full and he's looking at a whole host of things involving both the executive branch and the legislative branch, but that is not one of them.
We'll go there in a second. But before, before we do, Ken Lovett of the Daily News, here's the question. You're a married man, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you ask your wife where something is in the house, is she likely to know?
Yes and no. Look, if you know, there was this idea and
I say this, so let me just stop you. I say this because there was at least one shoebox filled with cash.
Yes.
That she said she didn't
know. $400,000. Yeah. But I got to be honest. I mean, if, frankly, if my wife hid something in the closet and it was buried under whatever.
I didn't say, would you know?
I wouldn't
have
known.
I said, would she know? The wife always knows.
I don't know if she would know, to be honest. And again, I'm not saying Judy Rapfogel knew or didn't know. I have no evidence one way or the other.
Sure.
I have no evidence to say she knew, but I can honestly say that, yeah, no, I think that to me is the most plausible. Now, the fact that they gave their son $100,000 to buy a house, you know, where that money came from, that may raise questions. But certainly, the fact that, there was a box filled with cash, I can understand that being hidden and her not finding it. I'm not saying yay or nay, but...
Remember that politician only years ago, and they found all this cash frozen in his refrigerator. Okay, so let me just start with you and ask you about the Moreland Act, because this is really hot stuff. Andrew Cuomo goes out, he appoints a Moreland Act commission, which is going to look into skullduggery wherever they can find it. They're going to be independent. He puts DAs and people of real resources on, but he still maintains some kind of control. Let me see if you disagree with this, because the people who are actually running the commission are basically gubernatorially appointed.
Right. We've written a lot. Let's step back one second. Last year, after a couple of lawmakers were arrested by the feds, the governor, it started kind of blowing back on the governor poll-wise, and he said, look, we need to do something. So I want this ethics package, and he put it out there. And he kept saying, if I don't get it, I'm going to form this Moreland Commission. And that raised a little bit of eyebrows, because basically what he was saying was, if you don't give me what you want, I'm going to have you investigated.
Right. That's what he said.
But ultimately, he
did. And he was very smart the way he did it, right? Because he got together with Schneiderman, the attorney general, who he doesn't seem to get along with too well.
No, and he deputized them. So they come together, they do this. Earlier this year during the budget talks, the governor gets an ethics package that he can live with, and he decides to dissolve the Moreland Commission.
Did he get enough in that ethics package he could live with? I thought he did not.
Well, depends on who you're looking at, what you're looking for. Anything that he had proposed that would have impacted him got cut out of the final ethics deal. So the fact that they were going to close various loopholes that he takes advantage of, those loopholes still exist. The fact he was going to lower contribution limits and he gets the most money, the limits remain the same. So anything that really was going to impact him, he kind of moved off of when they said no, and he got some other things that should be, it's a good move, but did it go as far as everyone thought it would or should have in exchange for the Moreland? No, I'd probably say most people say not. However, what we should say is last year in September, I think it was, I wrote a series of stories about the governor's office getting involved with the Moreland Commission
and
interfering.
As far as I was concerned, you deserved a Pulitzer for that.
What we showed was that, originally the governor kept saying when he formed this thing, it will be independent. They can look into anything they want to look into. Follow the money. But then it turned out that his aides had told the commission, yeah, you don't want to send that subpoena to the Real Estate Board of New York, which is a big supporter of his. The commission pulled back a subpoena originally that was to go to the Democratic Party housekeeping account that just happened to be funding ads that year promoting the governor's agenda and got millions of dollars that it never got before, raised $7 million, $6 million. But they didn't look at that. There were others as well that they held back. Governor's people said, no, we advised, but we didn't order. But certainly commissioners were upset. They felt that there was interference. And ultimately, all they were really looking at was the legislature. They decided they were not going to look into the governor or the attorney general. Now they disband it. And out of nowhere, Preet Bharara, the aggressive Manhattan U.S. attorney, says...
Who used to work, I think this is a very important thing to say, for Chuck Schumer.
Yes.
Go ahead.
And Schumer and the governor, not exactly close pals.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
See, I didn't know that part of it. I did know that Preet Bharara, being a political animal himself, obviously coming out of Schumer's office, ran that office, and was therefore appointed by Schumer.
Yes.
Is now going after him.
Now going after the governor.
Yeah. And that's where it looks.
And what he said was, I don't like how this looks, basically. He said the Moreland Commission was doing important work and it got cut off before its time. It shouldn't have been. It looks like, I'm not saying it is, he says, but it looks like it was traded as a quid pro quo for an ethics reform package.
Is that a felony?
Which the governor, I don't think so. Look, the governor created the thing.
It's what he says. He says, listen, I created it. It's mine. I can't.
But even a lot of his critics say they don't know where the crime would be. That doesn't mean, you know.
Right.
And he wouldn't rule out looking at the governor. But, you know, the governor's action and whether there was interference. He said he was very disturbed by reports of interference.
But he's impaneled a grand jury.
He's impaneled a grand jury, and one of the, you know, he's basically said, I'm going to carry on the Moreland's work. He grabbed control of all the Moreland files, and he all the investigations of the lawmakers that were going on, he says he's going to look at what they were doing, and if there's any unresolved leads, he's going to take it up. And, you know, people on the Moreland said there could be 7, 10, 12 things that they found that could result in criminal charges. But on top of that, he also has not ruled out looking at the governor and his handling of the situation.
Wow. I mean, we all know a little bit about Andrew Cuomo, and, you know, he's got a little bit of a temper. He's thoughtful, and he's strategic. So this happens. Placing oneself into Andrew's place, what would one do? Would one get on the phone with Chuck Schumer and say, you know, we can all play at this game, or how would it work?
I don't think he's messing with this one. Guy's running around with a grand jury subpoena. I think, you know, as someone wrote, I forget where I read it, but he's finally found someone he cannot bully.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you cannot bully a U.S. attorney. And all the tactics the governor has used on the legislature, the legislative leaders, the comptroller, the attorney general, aren't going to work. Those bag of tricks are not going to work here. And, you know, we'll see what Preda's up to. It's certainly a headache for the governor right now in an election year that he was hoping he was just going to cruise. I'm not quite sure how much of this is resonating greatly within the halls of power at the Capitol.
Right.
But I'm not sure yet it's resonating out in the public. You know, the governor is still relatively strong. He's still popular. He's got a candidate, an opponent, Republican Rob Astorino, who I think is a terrific Republican candidate.
Been on this very show.
But I'm not sure at this point, you know, he has the money or the wherewithal to mount a major campaign, but he's working it hard. He's all around. And the truth is, he's in a position where if something does happen and Andrew Cuomo slips, this guy could take advantage. He's good. He's a good candidate.
He is. Let me start by asking you about the Working Families Party. This is fascinating. We, on this show, too, we had one, Karen Scharf, on, who's one of the leaders of that party. There was a major poll, and what did it show? It showed Cuomo still leading by 30 points over Astorino. But if the Working Families Party nominated a candidate to be named later, not even with a specific name, his numbers fell from 30% lead to 15% lead, and that gets dangerous for the governor.
It said that an unnamed Working Families Party would get 24% of the vote. That seems awfully high.
It's huge.
But what, you know, considering third-party candidates often get 4, 2, 5, 6%. But really, the story here is a lot of people on the left are unhappy with the governor. And the governor wants to ring up a huge victory just in case Hillary Clinton doesn't run in 2016.
Sure.
He's, you know, behind the scenes, he's still keeping any kind of presidential bid open. You know, it's unlikely at this point. But, you know, he wants to have a big victory that would give him national credentials. So, you know, 60% or above would do that. So say, you know, there's no doubt that unless something huge happens, there's a very little chance that the governor is going to lose. But if they do run a third-party candidate, the Working Families Party, and forget the 24%, another poll that was commissioned showed anywhere, but depending on the candidate, would get between 6 and 14%. So say it's the 6%. Let's go to the low end. Say a Working Families Party candidate got 6%. Big difference between getting 60% of the vote if you're the governor and getting 54%.
Hmm.
Say they got 8%, all of a sudden you're down to 52%.
Sure.
So, you know, the margin of victory, he'll still probably win big, but, you know, where he comes out, his percentage of the vote could suffer greatly if there's a third-party candidate.
So let's talk then about the Working Families Party itself. Here's the way I see it. The money comes from the unions who are part of it. And it's also filled with lots of liberal types, progressives, as we say. And there are a lot of them in New York. So what happens? Now we're told that Michael Mulgrew of the teachers union, the fiery teachers union boss in New York, is for Cuomo getting the nomination. And some of the progressives are not. What are your antenna picking up?
Well, that's it. There is a split. The unions, for the most part, want to back the governor. You know, it's a business decision. And especially if they feel this guy is going to win again, they don't want to alienate him and go to war with him. So the unions are there with him. The problem is the decision, which will be made at the May 31st Working Families Party nominating convention, the executive committee is made up of rank-and-file non-union people, necessarily. So 200 of them, I think.
Yeah, but still the union's standing there with a bunch of money in their hands.
So there is a split. You know, there is a split, and the unions are saying, well, we could always go somewhere else. We could do whatever. It's a real tough decision. I've got to be honest, and I wouldn't be shocked, but I still would be surprised if they do the third-person route. I just have not seen that within the Working Families Party. They've never rocked the boat that way in the years they've been around. They endorsed Andrew, you know, a couple of years ago they were under investigation, they still are actually, and they endorsed Andrew Cuomo, and they not only endorsed him, but they signed his on to his agenda. So, I mean, they made a political decision to back a governor whose agenda really was opposite of what they wanted to do, because they know if they don't get 50,000 votes on the line, the governor's line, they no longer have a guaranteed spot on the ballot.
But they get a lot more than 50,000 if they run an independent candidate, wouldn't they?
You would think so, but do they want to risk it? Mm-hmm. Because the governor has threatened privately to resurrect the long now dormant Liberal Party.
Which really stinks like fish. I mean, you know, in fact, the Working Party's family, if you'll allow me just this little comment, is the heir to the best of what the Liberal Party used to stand for. And now the Liberal Party has gone riddled with corruption at the time that it went out of business.
Except they've always been very pragmatic, the Working Families Party. Their dogma is very liberal and progressive, but, you know, again, they backed Andrew Cuomo, who was pushing property tax cap and pension reform, not stuff the unions are big on. They did not, despite, you know, kind of rewriting a little bit of modern history, they did not back Bill de Blasio until after the primary.
Sure.
So they are very safe oftentimes, they're very tentative. So I think they're worried about what would happen if they don't back the governor. And really, you can make all this discussion we're having and the Independence Party, and it does beg the question, should New York, you know, join all the other states pretty much and say, you know what, we're not going to have the cross endorsements anymore, you know, that the minor parties cannot have a major party candidate.
Why would both either party do that?
Well, why would the parties do it?
Yeah, well, the Republicans get the conservative nod.
Exactly.
The Democrats
get wouldn't want to do it, but it begs the question, like, what's the point of these third party?
Well, we know what the point is. The point is it helps the guys who are making the decisions. Maybe not the public, but the people. Let me change to tell you another thing that really sort of gets my goat and I'm always interested in. And that is the four Democrats who crossed over.
Five
who crossed over to endorse the Republicans in the Senate, keep them in office. My view has always been this is not magic. The governor wanted the Republicans kept in power. He didn't veto the bill he said he would veto, letting them draw their own districts. And he hasn't called them in and said to Jeff Klein, the leader of this group. So now Jeff Klein is getting an opponent. Mm-hmm. The erstwhile Ali Coppell, back a blast from the past, former attorney general and a brilliant sort of mind. It always reminds me a little of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, although every time, because he has a sort of patrician's voice, every time I say that, he gets mad at me because he says I was born and raised in the Bronx. So does he have a chance of ousting Klein?
I think it's an uphill battle. Klein is a prolific fundraiser. He is popular in his district. He's well-known. So
he brings home the bacon.
He brings home the bacon. He's a leader in the chamber right now. I think it's an uphill battle, but you never know. You know, depends on turnout. It's going to depend on where the voters come out from, you know, because it's a Bronx/Westchester seat. I would be surprised if Coppell wins, but, you know, again, not shocked. There's a lot of anger at Jeff Klein.
For being a traitor.
And that's Coppell's words, that he was a traitor. And that's what he's running on, that he said, he ran as a Democrat, and now he's aligned himself with the Republicans. And Coppell argues, he even went back on his word that, you know, this would make it easier to get progressive legislation through, and we haven't seen that yet. Klein, of course, would argue differently. Klein would say, we got the gun bill during this coalition, you know, the gun control bill. They got a minimum wage hike. They, you know, he'll argue that they did get progressive issues, but The progressives, the liberals say, you know, the items themselves, some of them were watered down, like the minimum wage hike, and they didn't get enough.
Congressman Grimm, speaking of arrests, has been arrested. What's that about?
That's a good word. It's grim. It's just
very
another,
grim.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Staten Island.
Yeah, Staten Island, a Republican. The Republicans in the Congress are running away from him. You know, he's defiant. He's a former Marine. He says he's going to fight. He plans on running, and but we'll see what happens.
That was a seat that they had counted on, the Republicans, and now it looks dubious.
Yeah, it certainly does. And I think
this was not for something he did in office. This is before.
Right, and I think they would rather have a Republican who doesn't have the baggage, because, you know, every seat's going to count.
85-year-old Joe Bruno, the former majority leader of the New York State Senate, a very powerful man, brought so many things to his district. They used to say one more thing and the district will sink. It has to do with whether or not he has traded things for votes. If you can catch somebody saying something like that into a microphone, you know, the guy goes to jail. But there is no microphone in this case.
No, this is a very odd case, and it's a hard case because they brought it already. And the feds brought 8 charges against Bruno, basically saying he was acting as a private consultant and trading on his position as Senate Majority Leader to make money on the side.
So what's new?
And, so he was brought up on the charges. During the case, the first trial, which was, you know, a couple of years ago, 5 years ago, the feds basically said, this is not an issue of quid pro quo. We're not out to prove bribery. We're out to prove theft of honest services, basically. But what? And he got convicted of 2 of the 8 charges.
The law comes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court,
threw out
theft of honest services thing. They bring him back up again 5 years later.
5 years later, they bring it up back, and they say, now we're going to prove bribery, quid pro quo. Yeah. And to a lot of people, and you know, I understand the argument, it seems like double jeopardy. You used your strategy. You lost, ultimately, and now you're bringing it back up with a different legal strategy. Feds say they have a right to do it, and they're going after him, and the trial's ongoing as this week.
Joe Bruno, of course, has just had a cancer operation. He argued, could we have a shorter day? The judge looked at him and said, okay, but I don't want you standing out in front of the courthouse for an hour trying the case outside. But somehow, when he leaves the courthouse, somebody overhears him saying something, which has almost the same effect.
Yeah, look, Joe Bruno is a fighter, he's a scrapper, and he hasn't changed much. You know, whether he has cancer or not, which he did, I'm not saying whether or not he does, but shouldn't factor into a trial in terms. But, you know, the question here is what justice are they serving? You know, you had your case, you lost. Guy's 85 years old. He hasn't been in power in 5, 6, 7 years. And what are you going to gain out of this? It seems more about bruised egos, you know, that they lost the case.
Or they want to make a point that this legislature is so rotten and so corrupt that we have to go after it and make examples out of everybody.
But you went after it, and you lost.
You did.
So, you know, whether or not there's a lot of people who will disagree with retrying the case, but we'll see. You know, if he gets convicted, there's probably little chance he'll go to jail, but this could stretch on for quite a while if he gets convicted.
Our guest on the Capitol Connection has been the remarkable Ken Lovett, Albany bureau chief of the New York Daily News, author of the Albany Insider column, which you can read on Mondays in the paper. First thing that I reach for, Ken, when I get in here early in the morning and take a look at the paper, and you're always on top of things. So thank you so much for being with us.
Always fun.
The Capitol Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capitol Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capitol Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org, and NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decision to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.